we really need to consider what the audience is and what tools they use, how their perspective, and build that into the interface. That makes the product more inclusive and thereby accessible.
These are originally live chat sessions that I held, and you can join them in the future every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on sales.n.pixels on Instagram. My name is Koji, and this is Sales and Pixels.
Just to give a little bit of a background on Joel, Joel is the lead for accessibility at Delta Dental. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting is that he does have a background in as an engineer. So he used to build things, but he also has a background with design. So he used to design things himself. While he was actually losing his sight, he was still designing things, which was very impressive in my conversation that I have with him before this live. Welcome, Joel.
Hey, everybody. It's a pleasure.
Joel, I was talking a little bit about your experience as a full-stack engineer and a little bit of what you talked with me prior to this live about your career and how, you know, you end up in accessibility. Can you tell us more about that? Like, how did you start and what are the journey into find accessibility as your place today?
So I was actually in law school. But I found myself more interested in the internet and like how media got distributed on like the new quote unquote internet. And I started spending a lot of time and I started wanting to build that content. I still had a lot of sites still. So I was really interested in how people were doing different layouts at that time. And there weren't a lot of tools. So everything was pretty blocky at that time. I got more educated in tech, and I got out of school and I went straight into startups. And you know how startups are. You have to wear a lot of different hats. So coming from an engineering background, I'm pretty holistic. So I think of the whole system from like how it's built to how people respond to it. That's kind of because I have my undergrad's initially in psychology. So I think about like how people interact, how experience. I didn't even realize that was part of the web when I was just starting to get into it. But I've really thought on that level, and it really is that background in psychology and just interaction. I was in the startup. I had to do just about everything. It's like, okay, you get the requirements for what you need to do. You build something in the back end to support it. And then you start building the interface and you tie the two together.
And then you did design too, right?
You mentioned.
Yeah. I was never confident with my design, but it was always efficient. And I mean, it did what it was supposed to do, but a lot like the early Google pages, a lot of stuff that I did was more for workflow and efficiency rather than the design aesthetic. And that's one of the things that I gained from wearing a lot of hats in the product life cycle. It's that appreciation for designers and how they can put together colors and lines and just create an emotion.
Right. Interesting. And just to pause here, because I think this is fascinating. When we talked about this before, you said that you're losing sight when you were a designer. How was that process for you, like being a designer?
It was very slow at the time. So there were just things like colors that I'd always choose a really garish color palette because I wanted very high contrasts. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means like yellow backgrounds and bright blue. It looked kind of clownish to anybody else who would look at it.
But I bet it was very accessible.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The first thing I did, I've used all kinds of different platforms, but it was mostly using Windows. And one of the first things I did is I started to change the Windows colors.
Wow.
Yeah, so everything looked a little different. And as my vision started to get a little worse, I started to rely more on reversing the colors on the screen. And that was one thing that would make it really accessible. Because if something doesn't have the right contrast, you see it right away when you're X-raying the screen. Like things will disappear if they're not the right contrast.
That makes
So
a
it
lot
was
of sense.
unintentional, but I would be able to tell pretty fast by looking at the screen what was a good contrast and not without having to use the tools.
Yes, the tool that we have to use to simulate contrast, it was like for you, you didn't have to use anything.
Yeah, I learned how to use it though, because I always want to know the specifics. It's the engineer mind. I want to know if this is how close this is to contrast compliance.
Makes sense. Okay. And just to give a context for people who are watching us now, there is few patterns or standards on accessibility for contrast, right? The double way, the triple way.
And
Yeah, there's something called the
those
Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. And
the
when we talk about
WCK.
contrast, it's 1.4.3, and it talks about having a 4.5 luminosity on the two things that you are contrasting together. If things are bigger, the contrast doesn't need to be as high. But if they're smaller, the contrast has to go up more. Like with mobile and small screens, you need more contrast just because of the small footprint and just the lighting changes are more of an issue when you're using a mobile device than you are with this a static screen that doesn't have any issues with that being in the sun.
Right. And I know some designers use the plugin Stark to simulate that for Figma and Sketch, right?
There are a lot of tools that you can get even outside of Sketch. There's one that I used to use called the Color Contrast Analyzer. It was by a company called the Passiello Group. But there are lots of different color contrast tools that will fit into your design toolkit. It's just a matter of finding one that is accurate and that you find comfortable using.
Makes sense. Awesome. And I'm curious about how your background as a full stack engineer, as a designer, helped you in your accessibility specialist role.
It helped me to understand that there were a lot more things than just whether the database is giving you the right information. Every piece of the interface and the back end, they work together to make the full experience. So it made me realize that a lot of times we get cloistered in our own thinking and our own set of tools, but it made me really pull out of that and start to look at the whole thing. If anything fails on any level, then you have an experience failure. So if it's design, if it's accessibility, if it's engineering, any failure in any of that that's why we are all a very tightly knit team. And that's the main thing I learned, because before I would sit in the corner and code things out, and then it's like, oh, I'm done. So everything's done. But I really started to realize how false a sense of reality I had, because there are a lot more steps before it's really done. And maybe it's never done. It's a continuous process, because as people, we're constantly evolving our perspectives and what we think is comfortable and what we think is uncomfortable. So, I mean, design changes like that too.
That's true. That makes a lot. I love that. I think it does make a lot of sense that, as society evolves, design and everything we create with design needs to evolve together, right?
Absolutely.
Interesting. And what should we as designers or product managers or engineers should keep in mind when we're creating new products? if we want them to be accessible?
You really need to consider the entire audience. As people who are creating these products, we tend to use ourselves as the basis for our design or our engineering or our quality assurance. But we really need to consider what the audience is and what tools they use, how their perspective, and build that into the interface. That makes the product more inclusive and thereby accessible.
Right. And then there's not just like one aspect, right? Like there's vision,
exactly.
But it's
other things. If I'm looking at the accessibility on a product, I'm looking at it from a number of perspectives. I think about it from the use cases are like, what if this person is blind? What if this person is deaf? What if this person is low vision? What if they're deaf and blind? Mobility, cognitive issues. There's a whole set audience that you have to think of how your message translates. All in all, it's all about communication. It's like, how do you get your message to be understood by everybody that you want to communicate with?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember to see some of the devices that people use, right? Like people who have motor disability, they use this devices with like 3 buttons or a device that you put in your mouth or like eye tracking, right? There's so many different types of devices.
Different pointing devices and keyboards. I've seen keyboards that are meant for people with no hands. So they use their feet to type or they're using their eye tracking. There are different degrees of all of these things. Every cell phone that I know now has a switch on them so that somebody who has like paraplegia, they can use the switch to cycle through the choices on the interface and choose one by blinking or some like preset function. If they don't have their hands to use, they can use the switch instead of using their finger or using a keyboard.
Makes sense.
That's kind of how the on-screen keyboard works too. It's a giant switch, like multiple switches. So each key is like a little switch.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing because we think a lot about, you know, touchable devices and how people interact with computers and phones and mobile devices, but it's not just one way. There's so many ways how people today are already doing that, right? And we just don't over.
One of the things that really brought that home for me, like I told you, in startups, you're doing everything. So as the engineer who built this whole environment, somebody had the bright idea that he should talk to the customers. We don't know what to tell them. So that was another eye-opening thing for me because I was really stuck in my own world. But then you talk to a customer and it's like, this thing isn't working, or I do this and I do that. And you didn't even conceive that interface was capable of that. But people tend to teach you that you may have thought of 10 things, but now there's an 11th thing that you can think about more and you can make better.
Right.
And I know that, you know, sometimes people say, hey, we don't have budget, or this is too expensive to think about all these use cases and all this type of different users. And then when you look at the statistics, you know, like 1 out of 4 adults in US have some sort of disability. And in the world is an estimate of at least 1 billion people, right? That's a huge amount of people. What do you have to say when people, what do you say when people, you know, talk about budget and, you know, this is like too many edge cases.
Number one, that number is probably underreported because there are a lot of non-visible disabilities that people either are unaware that they have or they don't want to disclose because they find it embarrassing. So the numbers are slightly skewed. So it's probably higher. But a lot of times when I hear a lot of the pushback on building accessible products, it's based on fear or lack of knowledge. So instead of confronting that, a lot of times I explain what accessibility is and how it's achievable. It's just you have to consider it from the beginning in order to make it an easy transition. If you try to bolt it on after the fact, it becomes much harder, and you do become at higher risk for either customer complaints or even lawsuits. There has been an uptick in accessibility lawsuits in the last 3 years. They've been growing exponentially. Just within the disability community, there's a lot of frustration at how things are inaccessible. And in the legal community, they've already realized it's a low-lying fruit issue, that they can get money quickly. A lot of times that fear of lawsuit is what's driving accessibility movements. Unfortunately, the altruism of trying to make good products doesn't always work into the business case for it. Yeah. But we're trying to change that, to make it understandable that, you know, everybody should be counted. Everybody should be able to use this great thing that you're building. Why discriminate unintentionally and leave half of your audience out, and then be totally unaware that you can get this broader audience?
And it's not just the right thing to do, but it's also like a lot of people who, you know, would love to use your products and maybe they can't, right?
And you build community that way, as opposed to building separation and frustration.
That's very thoughtful. Well, thank you so much. I am learning a lot. There are so many studies that show that diverse teams build better products. And when you talked about all the types of disabilities, I thought like, well, it would be great to have, you know, representatives in the company so they could like voice their concerns and really like teach us how to build better products. So how important for you is to have people with disabilities in a company building products together?
It is important, just because it's that broader perspective. So that if you have a broader range of voices in your product development, your product development is more flexible and more inclusive, just by the fact that the team is diverse. So then if you have somebody who's blind in your team, now you really have somebody who's thinking about the screen reader. If you have somebody who has a mobility impairment, they're thinking about how things are spaced on the screen and how they can smoothly get to things. It can't be one person thinking of all this stuff, because we're all human. We can miss stuff. But if you have the broader diverse team to shoulder the whole project, then you can get a better perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. And once you have like a diverse team, let's say you did hire and you do have a diverse team somehow in some level, how do you make sure that people feel included?
Well, you have to bring them into the conversation. And do you mean in the product cycle or just in general?
I mean, in general, I would say both. Yeah.
Well, you know, accessibility parallels just civil rights in general. So if you think about how the thought of including people who are minorities, it's the same thing for accessibility. Mm-hmm. You have to make people feel comfortable. You have to understand where they are instead of guessing. So it's a lot about dialogue. I mean, we see this with Black Lives Matter now and some of these other movements that are happening. It's all about listening to those people and then having that conversation, being able to understand how their perspective can enrich you.
Got it. Yeah, listening for sure. That's very important. And I know that I have a couple of designers here watching us right now. And let's say I'm a designer and I want to learn, or I want to make sure that I apply accessibility somehow in the projects that I build. What are the best resources, or where should I start?
It really depends on your learning style. There are a lot of meetups in the area, and we live in the Bay Area. There's a accessibility meetup in San Francisco. There's a Silicon Valley accessibility meetup. So, I mean, you can go, well, right now it's all Zoom, but there are physical places that you can go to meet up and talk about accessibility with different people who have the similar thinking about it being important, but they all have diverse backgrounds and they represent different companies. Online, there are a lot of resources too. I wouldn't suggest just going straight to the guidelines because they're pretty dry and it's almost like reading a legal document. It's yeah. better to go to places like, what is it, A List Apart. That's one of my favorite design resources. Mm-hmm. There are accessibility companies like Level Access and Dequeue and Passiello Group that have designers that are at the heart of their company. One of the guys I worked with at Chase, John Folio, leads accessibility at Dequeue. Like a lot of the planning, he's part of that. And he came mm-hmm. from like a full design background. So it's like he talks about colors. Level Access has Feather. He was a Canadian designer. I'm forgetting his full name. But there you can find design conversations with accessibility. It's pretty mature. Feather has a good interview set every couple of weeks where they talk about how does color impact design and how do things like design systems impact accessibility. Right. A lot of good conversations to start with. A lot of introductory material. Apple has a lot of good stuff. Google has a lot of introductory material that's pretty good. There are a lot of resources. And then people like me, you can just, like you and I just picked up this conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, that's how it starts. You talk to somebody that, and you get an idea.
Yeah, I feel like meeting people who actually, you know, like as we do research and to meet the real users, we need to also make sure we reach out to people who have disability so we understand and we build that deep empathy, right? And it's not just like, oh yeah, the color, the contrast is done, we're good to go. You know, it's really to understand like what the context, when or how that person interacts with a computer or a phone or something like that.
Exactly. If you're going to make something for somebody, you need to understand what they need.
Mm-hmm.
You can't guess and you can't decide what they need for them. That usually ends up with a very angry customer because you inevitably give them something that's not usable to them or that's partially usable and then they're frustrated because they can't get to the whole thing.
One question that I got a lot is, okay, I do want to talk with people who have disabilities, but it's very hard to recruit people, those people to do research. Like, do you have any tips for that? How the designers or product managers can get in contact with maybe organizations or groups?
There are a lot of groups out there that focus on research. Like one, for instance, the Lighthouse of San Francisco, like on Market. I know they I sent user research opportunities to them. They get their own. There are places like the World Institute on Disability that also does research. Like they have their own pool of people. There are a lot of groups like this now that will bring people with disabilities into your organization. I can name at least 10 in San Francisco alone.
Yeah.
There's so many all over the place. Even the Independent Living Center of San Francisco has like a cross disability group there. So a lot of times when I have design questions, like how does this work if you're just using your voice to navigate through this web page or this phone? Like what are the design implications there? I tend to ask people there that who have those types of user experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But you just have to look. You need to know what you're looking for, but there are tons of resources.
Yep. And to be mindful, I do have a lot of followers from Latin America, from India, Brazil. If there is no clear place to go in your city, like, what do you recommend? Maybe reach out to a group that maybe is not connected to research, or do you have any other ideas?
Most countries have some kind of employment or like disabilities program. I know mm-hmm. in India there are a lot of them. Different countries have different formats. Like I know in Spain they have like a whole accessibility group there called ONCE.
Mm-hmm.
So it's spread out. You can, I'm sure you, if you look on the web, you can find it in your area. It takes different forms, but mm-hmm. it's definitely a growing piece that, you know, for me, I'm learning every day too. You know, you said that you're learning from this conversation, but just being out there, I'm learning new things about this area that I didn't, that was never part of my focus, but it's like every day I'm learning, oh, there's this thing in Brazil, this lady, she sings samba and she's losing her eyesight and she's done this thing in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, take the situation, take the person and change the place, and they could probably, it's probably apt, it's because it's growing everywhere. Everywhere from here to Australia to China, India, South America, like Argentina, there are people who are interested in accessibility all over. And it's just a matter of reaching out to them.
Makes sense. Cool. Yeah. Please, everyone, don't feel afraid to reach out to these organizations, because that's a great first step.
The bottom line is everybody's a person. So even if they have a different way of looking at things, or they use different tools, mm-hmm. You know, they're still people. So, I mean, you have to get over those barriers of discomfort and realize that there's nothing to worry about.
So now, Joel, I have this area called rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Do I need to be lying down on the couch?
No, it's good where you are.
Okay. Seemed a little Freudian.
Kind of, yes, that's the idea. So, okay, let's do it. Something you appreciate in yourself.
I underestimate my imagination and my ability to like put disparate things together and build something.
Awesome.
But I appreciate it when I do it unconsciously, and I wonder how I did it.
Something you love to do.
I like to sail. I like to be on the water. I'm not, if you ask people who sailed with me, they may say I'm not a very good sailor, but I really love being on the water. It's one of those things I started maybe 5 years ago, before not even having an interest in it. But I got onto the water, like in the bay, and it's like you feel the wind, you feel the water under the boat. It's like you're really connected to the earth. I have had very few experiences like that, and it's like in such a familiar setting, like San Francisco Bay. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. It's like I can understand all that spirituality that people talk about just by being on the
beautiful.
Water.
Love that. Is that in the marina area? Mm-hmm. Cool. I love that.
They're in Treasure Island.
Okay, cool. A song that reminds you of great times.
So, Electric Light Orchestra, Mr. Blue Sky. I may be dating myself, but it's mm-hmm. the song that my two-year-old will get up and dance to. And that's just like the most, that warms my heart to see him like happy and dancing to some song. And that one is always one that he will dance to and sway. He even tries to sing the words once in a while.
Well, I will definitely note that. We're listening later. A plan for next year.
I want to see more inclusion, more perspectives in products. I want to see that inclusion building. Yeah, I feel it now, but I want to see it like explode by next year.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Joel. Very inspirational. I feel very inspired right now to, you know, sail and use this great weather that we have right now. Well, we are unfortunately moving towards the end here. It's always very fast. I really enjoy talking with you. But I want to give you a space, you know, for last words, or if you want to share something, share your contacts, or, you know, whatever inspirational phrase, whatever you want to do here, the space is yours.
Oh, I appreciate that. If you want to talk about accessibility, I'm on LinkedIn and email, and I'm all over the place. I'm just starting to build my website. It's www.novaelis.com, N-O-V-A-E-L-I-S. There's nothing there right now. I'm working with one of my friends that used to be a designer at Disney to try to build a nice site that people can contact me through. But generally, email and LinkedIn is the best way right now.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Joel. I appreciate again. It's an honor to have you here. I'm pretty sure that people learned a lot as I did.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My name is Koji, and this is Cells and Pixels. Every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on cells.n.pixels on Instagram. Thanks for listening.